is Clearstead's Investment Forum, where we hold discussions with allocators, managers, and other industry leaders on current investment trends and topics. These conversations are led by members of our investment office who conduct research on investment strategies. Thank you in advance for listening, and we hope you enjoy the discussion.
Hi, I'm Joe Schellen. In today's episode, we are fortunate to have Fred Cummings, president and founder of Elizabeth Park Capital Management, speak with us today about recent events and investment trends in the banking sector. Fred's also had 30 plus years in the banking sector, so he brings a great viewpoint, but he also manages a fund that invests in the space, and we'd love to hear about the opportunities and that might be coming from this dislocation. Fred Cummings is the president and founder of Elizabeth Park Capital Management. He serves as portfolio manager for the privately held alternative asset management firm focused on long-short equity, event-driven, and customized investment opportunities in the investment banking sector. The firm supports community bank technology investment through a partnership with Strandview Capital and the BTEC Consortium Fund. The firm is the investment manager for the Mission Driven Bank Fund. Fred serves as the firm's investment committee for the BTEC Consortium Fund and the Mission Driven Bank Fund. Mr. Cummings is an investment and banking portfolio manager with 30-plus years industry experience leading disciplined, client-focused investment practices. His esteemed performance established himself as a principled bellwether across the investing and banking industry. His singular focus on banks, paired with his curated approach to investing, M&A, and risk analysis, transcends the Elizabeth Park mission to be the best bank investment firm in the country. Prior to founding Elizabeth Park, Fred achieved a distinguished 17-year career at KeyBank Capital Markets as one of the sell side's foremost senior analysts covering the banking sector. He additionally served as a senior analyst for FSI Group, a financial services hedge fund. He launched his career at McDonald & Company as a sell side junior analyst. Fred earned his BA in economics with honors from Oberlin College. He actively supports Oberlin's Connect Cleveland initiative and Business Scholar Speaking Program as an honored guest speaker for 23 consecutive years. He is an alumnus and ardent supporter of Western Reserve Academy. Fred dedicates his time serving on several boards, including Oak Street Net Lease Trust, the Marshall Project, and Nirvana Analytics. He serves an investment committee member for Western Reserve Academy and is a former member of Laurel School's Investment Committee. Fred was named 2017 Crain's Cleveland Business Who's Who in Cleveland.com's People to Watch in 2015. As an industry expert, he has been featured on various media outlets, including The Wall Street Journal, Inc. Magazine, Crain's Cleveland, CNN Money, was on actually on CNBC yesterday, and was cited expert in the recently published book by Wiley called Bank Investing, a Practitioner's Field Guide. Fred lives in the Cleveland area with his wife. Fred, welcome to the podcast. For those in the audience who aren't familiar with you or Elizabeth Park, can you tell us a little bit about your background and how did you come to found Elizabeth Park?
Well, thanks, Joe. It was great to be here. But yeah, my background, grew up in Akron and went to Western Reserve Academy for there, matriculated to Oberlin College and graduated a degree in economics. And I was fortunate to join McDonald Investments back in 1989. And in 1991, I got promoted to become the senior bank analyst at McDonald Investments. And I covered the banking sector for McDonald from 89 until 2007. I had always wanted to allocate capital. And after leaving McDonald Investments to KeyBank in 2007, I started my own fund, Elizabeth Park Capital Management, which focuses on investing in banks with a long short strategy. We invest in the bottom 500 banks, all but the top 10 banks in the country. That's our sweet spot. And then in 2016, we launched a second fund, a long only bank consolidation fund that's meant to take advantage of the secular consolidation trend that occurs in the space. And so we have those two products, and then we will also manage a long only strategy for a selected clients focused on larger banks, where we're trying to outperform the S&P Regional Bank Index.
That's great. And as you sort of look at the banking sector more broadly speaking, what makes it an attractive investment opportunity for Elizabeth Park, and what are you guys sort of looking for?
Yeah, well, we are. What we like about banks is that they are great value stocks, and they pay nice dividends, and you compound your money over time. And we're looking for well-managed companies that have, first and foremost, great deposit franchises. The recent events over the last 2 weeks really underscore why core deposits really define a bank's franchise value. We want to own banks that are well-capitalized. And frankly, we also like to own banks that have relatively low efficiency ratios. That's a sign of a well-managed company. Then lastly, credit quality. Credit quality is fundamentally important when you're investing in banks. And we want to invest in banks where we think their credit quality will outperform their peers. So in short, bank stocks oftentimes offer great risk reward, particularly when there's a lot of dislocation in the market, as there is today, and concerns about specific issues. And today's issue, of course, is liquidity. And we have some thoughts about why the market might be overly concerned about a liquidity that I'm going to talk about.
That's great. And actually, maybe at least this is our next question. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on today's market? And how does that volatility and stress in the banking sector today compare to, you've been in this space for a number of years, right, through a number of cycles. So how does this compare to sort of the past cycles?
Yeah, well, I'll answer the last question first. Yeah, this cycle is much different. Previous cycle was in 1990. That was a commercial real estate crisis. And then you look at 2001, we had the internet bubble. The banks went through that downturn relatively unscathed. And of course, in 2007, 2008, there was systemic risk in the banking system owing to a subprime mortgage lending, owing to very aggressive construction and land development lending related to the housing market. And this cycle is much different in that the banks are very strong from a profitability standpoint, capital and liquidity. This is really more a crisis of confidence as it relates to perceptions about liquidity, a risk, and as defined by a bank's ability to fund deposit withdrawals. And we think that liquidity risk has been misunderstood and misplaced. If one looks at the underlying flexibility that banks have to generate cash to fund deposit outflows, the first and most important way in which they fund deposit outflows is to raise new deposits. Secondly, banks typically are getting significant cash flows from customers repaying their loans, and also from the maturation of securities. And then lastly, the banks have the ability to borrow from the Federal Home Loan Bank to fund deposit outflows. And we're frankly really surprised how the situation spiraled from what should have been an earnings issue has become run on banks. And I think when you specifically look at the situation at Silicon Valley and Signature, both of those banks had unique deposit verticals. Silicon Valley, of course, was focused on the fund banking business, had high concentrations of deposits coming from both the venture capital and private equity sectors. And in particular, the venture capital segment had some risk with respect to portfolio companies using cash to run their businesses. And they were not accessing additional rounds of capital. And that's resulted in deposit outflows in that segment. And to a lesser extent, that probably happened in private equity as well. And so they had a unique deposit vertical. And then they also were taking some interest rate risk on the bond side, where they were buying longer dated bonds. But nevertheless, they had the ability to sell those bonds. And while they would have taken a loss, they still would have remained well capitalized. So we are really surprised that this resulted in a run on the bank. And I think that does speak to some of the changing technology that with respect to mobile banking and the ability to move money around very, very quickly with one's phone or at a computer. And we think this creates a great opportunity, though, for other banks, in that this contagion risk that you currently hear about, that doesn't seem to be happening as we speak with portfolio companies that we own, and as we've listened to conference calls with banks across the country. Most are saying that their clients are not panicking and it's business as usual. We think that's going to be reflected in first quarter operating results in April. And we think there will be a relief rally as a result. So this contagion risk doesn't seem to be happening. And I know banks will be talking about deposit flows in great detail when they report earnings in April. So this is more of a crisis of confidence and less so a reflective of deteriorating fundamentals, as was the case in previous down cycles for banks. And as a result, the risk reward to us looks very compelling. Bank stocks are trading today at 140% of tangible book value. They last traded at that level in the fourth quarter of 2020, which preceded a 50% move in the stocks in 2021. And so on a valuation basis, banks are very attractive. You look at their dividend yields for the S&P Regional Bank Index, that median dividend yield is 3.7%, which is very attractive. And you also look at, as I said earlier, strong capital levels, relatively strong profitability levels. And then lastly, we believe the banks have more than adequate balance sheet liquidity.
Yep. And so what's the typical or long-term average tangible book value of a bank? Where do they typically trade?
Yeah, that's a great question, Joe. They typically trade closer to 175 of tangible book, and they normally bottom when you have concerns about credit risk. As we did in 2020, third quarter 2020, a bank's bottom at 95% of tangible book. And typically when you buy banks below book value, there's a high probability that you make money. And even in today's environment, there are a number of banks trading below tangible book, given the broad-based fears, one, about liquidity, and then two, a slowing economy and potentially credit concerns. One byproduct of this liquidity scare is that banks will likely tighten their credit standards, and that will result in a lower loan growth for the sector. And of course, that could negatively impact the broader economy. So we do expect for loan growth to slow. But most importantly, we have to be mindful of what's going to happen with credit risk. And today, credit quality is simply outstanding for the banking sector. Net charge-offs, Joe, are 5 basis points, and a normal level of net charge-offs would be 15 to 20 basis points. So the real question this year and going into 24 will be, at what level will a net charge-offs rise to? It's our view that net charge-offs should remain, should rise to a more normalized level, which would be in that 15 to 20 basis points range. If indeed that happens, I think the bank stocks in some cases could double. Some banks will double in value off these relatively low valuation levels.
Actually, at least I have a couple of questions on that answer. So I'm going to go back to the bank run side of things a little bit first, and we actually would love to get some more details on how the bank loan portfolios look for some of these banks. But so, you know, obviously you mentioned one of the issues with the bank run was the concentrated exposure for Silicon Valley Bank. I mean, we actually have clients invested in a lot of private equity and venture capital. And we talked to them on Thursday, Friday that week. It's kind of like you could sort of see everybody, to your point, everybody was logging into the computer to get their money back and out. So it's like you could kind of see it, you kind of can kind of see the train coming down the tracks and the potential risk. But you know, I mean, some of the things that people have also brought up with Silicon Valley Bank is the high rate of deposits that were not FDIC insured. So maybe that, are there any other factors that sort of led to the bank run outside we already talked about? And then and maybe the second part of that question is now that the FDIC has come in insured all deposits, does that sort of change some of the risk also for some of these institutions?
Yeah. That was clearly an issue. Uninsured deposits. Now, they had an outsized level of uninsured deposits. I think their uninsured deposits may have been north of 70% of their total deposits. The average bank's uninsured deposits are roughly 35 to 40%. And so uninsured deposits, there's nothing new about that in the sector. But I think you got to look at the business line concentrations more so than the level of uninsured deposits. You have to look at the type of deposits and where they're coming from. And we did talk about another bank that went under, and that's Signature Bank, and then they had a relatively high level of deposits related to the digital asset industry. And we all know that that is a higher risk business line, and we would not have thought of venture capital and private equity lending businesses being higher risk, but clearly venture capital has some unique economic characteristics out of favor now, not as much capital being deployed. And I felt that though, as though that was more of a short-term issue, because venture capital in the U.S., it will rebound. But that was an issue. But banks have always had relatively high levels of uninsured deposits. But what's interesting, Joe, though, is that there are products that exist that allow banks to address that issue. With a company called Intrify, where one can get up to 150 million of insured deposits per relationship, and the custodial bank, which would be the relationship bank, they set the rate for the borrower, and then the other banks that participate in that deposit consortium, I'll call it. They pay that depositor the same rate. And I think what you're going to see happen is more banks will be educating their customers about that product. Silicon Valley Management clearly did not do a good job with interest rate risk management. And if they had simply had a shorter duration bond portfolio, that would have greatly helped their cause. And we might not be having this conversation today had they operated the bank in that fashion. Then frankly, also have to say, what were the regulators doing? Because the regulator's job is to manage risk. And yep. When they're doing their exams, they need to focus on that issue. And then the last issue, Joe, that many people haven't talked about is rapid growth. Typically, the banks who do best are relatively slow growers, and banks are rewarded by having high profitability, not the most rapid loan and deposit growth. In the case of Silicon Valley, they were a very fast grower, as was Signature, and then frankly, even the other bank that failed recently, Silvergate, they were also a fast grower. And so that is one of the common characteristics of the three banks who fell is that they generated much faster balance sheet growth than their industry peers.
Yep, that's interesting. And it's just one more question on deposits, and I don't know if this actually pertains to the crisis, but I mean, obviously, interest rates on deposits that you're going to pay to keep your money in the bank short term are still pretty relatively low. Is there, do you think there's going to be a push by banks to actually increase that number a little bit? I think they've been hesitant to, outside of a few select banks, right? But
that's right. Yeah, Joe, I think they will. One, competition today is really heated up. And this rate rising cycle, the deposit betas have been unbelievably low since the first quarter of 2022. through year end 2022, deposit betas were only 13% cumulative. And now we expect deposit betas to really pick up here in the first and second quarters. And some banks just have great deposit franchises, but I do expect for banks to engage in more intense deposit price competition. And going back to an earlier question you asked about deposit insurance, I do believe in the near term it would be beneficial just to soothe nerves for the FDIC to temporarily insure all deposits as they did during the financial crisis in 2008. The longer term solution, we need to step back and say, well, what's best? And maybe that $250,000 insurance cap needs to be lifted. But I think near term today, a good step would be to simply insure all deposits, and that would calm the fears of consumers and notably small business owners.
No, that's great. That's good. And then we kind of hit on this one too. You know, how did mobile banking, social networks, price of transparency impact the recent bank closures, and how do you think they'll impact the industry going forward?
Oh yeah, no, that clearly was a key catalyst. The ability and ease in which consumers and businesses can now move money, that accelerated things greatly. Normally, it would require people waiting in line to withdraw their deposits. Now that you don't have to do that, you can do it. You can take your money out from the comfort of your bedroom. That risk is a risk that I think surprised everyone. And I think the regulators are going to look at ways to address that. But that fundamentally has changed the way the people view risk for the banks that they utilize. But longer term, though, when you look at the long-term track record of the banking sector, there are very few failures of this size, and most banks operate their business in a conservative fashion, and most banks have great trust, have earned great trust from their customers. But nevertheless, technology enabled this particular bank run and the bank run at Signature made it happen much more easily than anyone would have thought.
Yep. It's good. So we talked about this from a little bit from the deposit side, right? But we were talking about banks also have loan exposure, right? And so obviously the credit exposure to at Silicon Valley Bank was a little different, but you talked about the loan books for some of the smaller banks that you guys are investing. What does a typical loan book look like for a bank that you guys are looking at in your space of that small mid-sized bank side sector?
Yeah, the small and mid-sized banks, roughly 50 to 60% of the loan book will be in commercial real estate. That's both income producing assets, whether it be office, hotels, apartments, retail strip, shopping centers, industrial. And then a portion of that 50 to 60% would come from owner occupied real estate owned by businesses. So most of these mid-sized banks are real estate lenders, and they're lending to developers that they know in their backyards. In addition to that, they'll have 20% or so in their traditional commercial and industrial loan category, lending to business owners in their markets. They will also have some exposure to mortgage lending. Most of the regional banks like to make mortgage loans. And then lastly, they will do some home equity lending. What they don't do is a lot of leverage lending. They don't do a lot of credit card lending. And then, frankly, they don't do a lot of automobile lending. Credit card and automobile lending is dominated by the larger banks who have the economies of scale. But these community banks, regional banks, small regional banks, they're relationship lenders, lending to people that they know and within their geographic footprint.
That's good. And then maybe this is kind of two questions in one. So as we sort of talked about the loan book, are there banks or the portions of banks that maybe have higher exposures to certain loans that you guys are either avoiding or finding attractive? And the second part of the question is more broadly speaking, since we can move away from the loan side of things, you know, where are the best opportunities today, do you think, in the banking sector?
Yes. Yeah, we are clearly trying to avoid banks that have high concentrations in construction and land development lending, particularly if they generated a lot of growth in construction loans since 2021. We believe as those loans are completed, those projects are completed, they may have difficulty leasing them up. So that's an asset class that we're watching very, very closely. And then needless to say, given the secular changes in office and occupancy levels coming out of COVID, that's another asset class that we're monitoring very closely, and we haven't seen any cracks just yet, but a number of these office loans will be coming up for renewal at higher rates, and we'll see if their cash flows can allow them to absorb the higher borrowing costs. And with respect to opportunities, yeah, we think there are a great number of opportunities. So one, in general, we really like the super regional banks, names like Comerica, Citizens Financial, Huntington, and Fifth Third. All of those banks have sold off violently this month, and so for in part due to technical reasons, a lot of long-only investors made the decision to buy the money center banks, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, U.S. Bank, because they're going to benefit from deposit inflows, and then they're going to decided to sell the super regional banks since they're pretty liquid. We think that creates an opportunity because we think that's more of a technical issue, not a fundamental issue that drove their prices down. And all of the super regional banks have relatively high dividend yields, and they trade at relatively low price to tangible book multiples and relatively low PE multiples. So we love the super regional banks. Then the other great banks we really like would be a niche of regional banks who have unique operating characteristics, whereby some of them have very strong return on asset levels vis-a-vis the industry. Some of them are benefiting from cost synergies stemming from recent mergers. We want to own banks like Old National and Webster, who recently consummated acquisitions, and we think they have better earnings visibility coming from cost savings. And then you look at some banks are internal improvement stories. We own a bank in Texas, Texas Capital, one of the few banks that in Texas that trades below tangible book. They brought in a new CEO 2 years ago, and he's changing their business model from a wholesale business and to a relationship banking business. And we think that's really going to enhance their franchise value. Then the last one I would mention is Banner Corporation out of Washington State. Now, this is a bank that's also focused on an internal performance improvement. They are focused on cost control. They're also rolling out new products to better serve their customers. It has one of the best deposit franchises in the country. And they have a long history of being a good credit underwriter. So, Joe, there's a wide range of banks that are attractive, but those two buckets that I mentioned we find most attractive currently.
That's great. And then sort of on the super regional banks, I've heard stories about, you know, Bank of America, JP Morgan getting a big influx of deposits. How have they seen deposit flows in the super regionals? Have they gotten more deposits as people moved out of smaller banks? Have they been sort of muted because everybody's been going to the super regionals, or sort of how have the flows been for them?
Yeah, I think it's muted. So the super regional banks, when we look at Citizens, Huntington, Fifth Third, and Comerica, I think their deposits will be flat to down slightly here in the first quarter. It has been muted. The beneficiaries have clearly been the money center banks. At the smaller regional banks, some of them have got some deposit flows. But this year, Joe, we were expecting deposits to moderate anyway. And I think this is an important point for the listener to understand that banks due to quantitative easing, had record deposit growth of 21% in 2020. And in 2022, they had 13% deposit growth. The long-term trend is around 6%. And so the banks were significantly above trend in 2020 and 2021. Deposit growth moderated last year to about 2%. And we in fact, entering 2003, expected deposits to be down because deposit levels are normalizing and loan-to-deposit ratios are normalizing. So it wouldn't be a surprise for us to see bank deposits on average decline in 2023 due to that normalization process. Loan-to-deposit ratios today are abnormally low, and they, as a result of deposit growth slowing in banks, at least last year, they really accelerated loan growth. The loan-to-deposit ratios will increase. But we're going to be watching these deposit trends closely, as will other investors. But people should not panic because the bank's deposits are declining in 23, and because we think that was the natural course based on this normalization process.
Yeah, that's good. That makes sense. And so you mentioned one of the themes being bank consolidation. And so what is the current historical rate of bank consolidation? And do you think bank consolidation is going to accelerate, going to decelerate, sort of stay the same here, given what's sort of happened recently?
Yeah, I think the long-term trend is probably 4 to 5% of the industry consolidates each year. We think 2023 will be a relatively benign year. Given the economic uncertainty, the buyers don't want to buy someone else's problems. Once we get to better clarity about where we are in the economic cycle as we enter 2024, I do believe 2024 should be a very robust consolidation year, because we are expecting to come out of this some higher regulatory costs, and that will be challenging for all banks to a certain extent. This is a more difficult operating environment with slowing loan growth and maybe some margin pressure. So many small banks might decide to partner with a larger, stronger institution who's more diversified. And then, Joey, what we normally see in rebounds is that the smaller stocks typically lag the larger ones due to their relative lack of liquidity. And so that valuation gap between potential buyers and sellers will likely widen. So we think 2024 will be a very robust year for merger and acquisition activity. And our bank consolidation fund, we hope will be in a position to benefit from that.
Good. I mean, How many small mid-sized banks are there in the USA? I think you mentioned 500 as your coverage universe, but I mean, how big is that universe?
Oh, you're right. There's 5,000, and so you have the privates, Joe. There are a ton of them, and then frankly, there are a lot more public banks that we could cover. But since they're so illiquid, it would be tough for us to find the stock. So even though our coverage universe is roughly 500, it could easily be 650. Because there's another 150 small banks, generally with market caps less than 250 million, that we could potentially invest in, but a number of those companies are closely held, but at minimum, they just don't trade well enough for us to take a position. And so that's why there's always consolidation activity. There are just so many banks out there. And then you have management succession issues. That's another reason why banks decide to sell. But what will change, Joe, is buyers are most interested in a bank with a great deposit franchise. And that's the situation over the last 10 days really underscores why deposits are so important. Without deposits, there's really not a lot of franchise value. And you could be in the wealth management business, that's different. But in the traditional banking business, making deposits and generating loans, the deposits are more valuable than the loans. And so the banks who have great deposit franchises, there will always be strategic buyers interested in those franchises.
That's good. And now we talked about, obviously, consolidation is a theme over the next couple of years. And we talked about some of the recent themes. Any other themes you sort of expect to materialize over the next couple of years?
I think there's going to be a differentiation in credit profile over the next 12, 18 months. Those banks who have been disciplined in their approach to allocated credit, I think we're going to see some a differentiation on that front as well, and that's probably the most important issue that we are looking at going forward is how will credit quality progress over the next 12 to 18 months.
You think that side of ledger might lead to some more bank closures? That
no, I don't think the issues will rise to that level. I think it could lead to more bank consolidation, and then some of the banks that might sell at depressed the multiples if they have a credit issue. Banks love to buy other banks when they are in distress. They can get them at a very low multiple, particularly if they operate in good markets where you have population growth. And so we do think that could be a catalyst for some M&A when another bank has a problem, but it has to be a manageable problem. A stronger institution may swoop in and take advantage of that opportunity to buy a bank at a relatively low valuation level.
Yeah, that makes sense. And now you've covered the banking sector for multiple cycles, as we sort of highlighted earlier in the conversation. So what are some of the most important lessons you learned as a bank investor over time?
Well, credit is job number one, because that's normally where you have the risk of permanent loss of capital. The bank runs I've never experienced before, but you got to be flexible in terms of how you look at these banks, because that was a new dynamic. And so we're going to take a look at we've always looked at the mix of the deposits, but I think you're going to see much more transparency around that, Joe, going forward.
Yep.
By the analyst community. We fundamentally look at the soundness, which would include credit quality, capital, liquidity, and then again, going back to this issue of growth, profitability is much more important than growth in terms of delivering shareholder value over time. Typically, banks that grow too fast are taking on too much risk. We've always known that to be the case on the loan side. And now we're learning that that also could be the case on the deposit side. To grow your deposits too fast, you might not be able to put those deposits to work in an efficient fashion. And so profitability is more important than growth. And then the last thing I will say, when we look at the banks, we love to see banks compound tangible book over time. And that's really how you generate great shareholder value for the sector, with the combination of tangible book growth along with dividend growth, makes for a good long-term investment for a bank stock investors.
That's good. And then, you know, as you sort of look in the banking sector going forward, I mean, there's some alternative concepts, whether it's narrow banks and some growth in fintech, things like that. Sort of, what are your thought process of how the banking sector might evolve over time? Are these alternatives, do they pose some risks to the traditional banking sector?
I think it clearly presents more deposit competition, but the banks have evolved nicely with the adaptation of technology and their ability to track deposits nationally without having a branch in those markets. And clearly the bigger banks, the money center banks, lead that at JP Morgan and B of A. They just have the ability to spend a lot more money on technological development and products and people. So banks are going to continuously invest in technology to help serve their customers better, to help improve productivity internally, and then frankly, to create a new products. And that ability to invest in technology is a differentiator, Joe, and that'll help drive consolidation as well, because some of the smaller banks just don't have the resources or the manpower to invest in technology, and more importantly, to apply it and to help improve their operations. So technology will be a differentiator, competitive differentiator, but the banks are competing very effectively against the fintechs. And I measure that, Joe, when I look at what's going on with deposits, because banks, again, had great deposit growth in 2020 and 2021, which showed me that they were not losing market share to the fintechs, and the banks have a lower cost of deposits. There's still real franchise value there versus the fintechs, who have more brokerage CDs and higher cost money market accounts. So the banks are well positioned, particularly the mid to large size banks. They are exceptionally well positioned, and they have a lot of talented people. They're focused on it, and they're going to continue to invest resources in that area.
That's good to hear. And then, so we talked about the lending side of the business. We were talking about quite a bit. You expect some of the banks to tighten their credit standards going forward. Obviously, you know, they have solid books, and I think as we look, we are investors in private equity, venture capital, and so. You know, and actually even private credit sometimes, right? So how do you think, private credit firms and funds in general, they've been raising a ridiculous amount of capital, and everybody we know in the private market landscape seems like they're raising credit funds over the last 5 or 6 years. And so how has that sort of impacted the traditional lending of banks, and how do you think that sort of evolves going forward?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you asked that, because we've been doing a lot of work on that, Joe. And I think that's a part of the reason why we feel better about bank balance sheets, because of the private markets, the non-bank lenders have taken a lot of market share away from the bank, particularly in what could be perceived as higher risk area, like leveraged lending, and then even in certain aspects of commercial real estate. And you see that in the numbers. And when you look at the syndicated loans and the distribution of those syndicated loans by credit grade, what is clear is that the non-banks are taking on higher credit risk, and they're taking on more non-investment grade credits that the banks are focused on, the investment grade credits. And so we're going to see how that plays out this cycle. And the FDIC just recently completed the Shared National Credit Exam, and what the results, maybe it was FDIC or OCC, but what the results show was that the criticized asset levels, which are loans that are performing, but banks and the non-banks have concern about, criticized asset levels are much higher for the non-bank lenders than they are for the bank lenders. So I think that underscores the fact that the banks have less credit risk in that asset class, and we're anxious to see how that plays out. And that was part of the de-risking process that banks went through following the financial crisis. And that's another reason why we generally feel good about the credit outlook, is that there have been some other players taking some of the higher risk opportunities off banks' balance sheets.
It's funny you're talking about that. Actually, we've talked to private lenders for the last 10 years or so, and it's some of them actually source their opportunities from banks who have partnerships and relationships with someone, but the loan's a little too risky. So it's a chance for them to provide a solution without actually taking that, to your point, that riskier loan on the balance sheet, right? So it's interesting. So
yeah. So we're going to be putting out some data on that soon.
Yep. Now we talk about, you know, maybe tighter lending standards. I mean, as we sort of look at our broad portfolio, you mentioned tightening maybe in real estate. Any other sectors you think they could tighten in? And the other thing that we've talked about a little, we're talking about smaller regional banks too, and so those are usually pretty important in the markets that they serve as a provider of capital, right? So, how do you think this crisis could impact their ability to sort of help their regions, and in particular, even Northeast Ohio. So maybe we can talk about our region. So
yeah, and I'd say first in other asset classes, we know that assisted living is an asset class that some banks are mindful of because Medicare reimbursement rates have not kept pace with inflation, and so there could be some cash flow problems at some of these operators. So that's one we're looking at. And then we've heard some concerns about transportation. And in a high inflationary environment, you get concerned about how small businesses will perform because they have less of an ability to pass along the higher costs to their customers. Fortunately, here in Northeast Ohio, as we look at the major banks and even some of the smaller banks, again, they're operating from a position of strength. When I think about KeyBank, I look at Huntington, I look at PNC, and Fifth Third. So all of those banks are very strong, will have the ability to provide credit to creditworthy clients. I do think their underwriting standards will tighten. They may want more equity in real estate deals, and they're going to look at the debt service coverage ratios very closely and the typical C&I deal. But we have a lot of strong banks here in Northeast Ohio. That's on the high end. Then you have a number of regional banks like F&B Corporation. They're a good bank. First Commonwealth is here in Northeast Ohio. They're a good bank. Farmers National's People. So we have a strong network of banks here. And while credit conditions might be tighter, it's always available to good operators. And again, banks are relationship oriented. They're long-term relationships. They want to work with their customers. And the good banks are not transaction focused. So Joe, I don't see a credit crunch at all. I just see a tightening of standards in certain asset classes, but we would not expect to see a credit crunch.
That's good. That's good to know. So I also like to, when we do these podcasts, get to understand you a little bit better, understand the organization, Elizabeth Park. So, you know, you build a decent team as you sort of look to build out your team. What were the qualities you're looking for in your team members, and what makes a good bank analyst in your opinion?
Yeah. So our teammate, we run this like a family business and a partnership. And so we're looking for people who are hard workers, who are team oriented, and who are, who have a strong interest in making this a successful long-term venture. And frankly, I've hired a lot of people that I've previously worked with because I think you know better that the risk of surprises is lower. And so, but we have a very collaborative culture and that's something that I really look for when we're adding the team members. Now, this has been a very difficult job market. We've been looking for a controller for some time. So if you have any recommendations, Joe, let us know.
No, that will definitely will. Yeah.
What was the second part of that question?
Right. Yeah. What makes a good bank analyst?
I think, well, a good bank analyst, you got to be disciplined and you're process driven. Because it's tough. Banks are tough to cover because they're only transparent to a certain extent because you never know fully what's in that loan portfolio. And now we've learned you never know fully what's in the deposit mix. And so you have to try to be very diligent in your approach and focusing on the numbers. You got to be able to ask good questions of management. I think that's the most important thing because management will answer the question, but you've got to ask them the right question. So you got to ask very good questions with management. And then you have to have a good sense for, particularly on the credit side, of how to diligence their underwriting process and their standards and their risk appetite. And then you have to have valuation discipline as well, because banks can be volatile and you can't be afraid to buy them when they're out of favor. And particularly when they trade below book, typically that's the best opportunity to buy bank stocks over the years. When they trade below book and when a business is profitable, frankly, it should trade below book because book is growing. Tangible book is growing if you're profitable. And so right now, when we look at certain banks trading below book, the market, it could very well be mispricing risk. And typically, you only lose money at a bank when you have a credit issue. So that's why credit is so important. So that's how we look at it. We have a very disciplined process. We look at the numbers and we look at time series data to allow us to put things in perspective, and like the normalization of the balance sheet that's occurring right now as loan deposit ratios normalize, borrowings to assets normalize, as debt charge-off ratios normalize. You have to look at time series data, I think, to really understand where banks are in the cycle.
Yeah, that's good. And then just you personally, what sort of led you to the investment management industry?
Well, I'm a big fan of Warren Buffett, and I always wanted to allocate capital like Buffett. And so I said, I'd love to do that. And when I was a student at Oberlin College, I read the sections of the Wall Street Journal every day in the library, Mudd Library, so that's what led me to want to become an investor, is to allocate capital. And Buffett likes bank stocks too.
He owns banks. That's true.
Joe, he owns a lot of bank. So that's what led me to the business. And I just think it's the best thing. It's intellectually challenging. And there are no boring days, particularly right now. It's never boring.
Yeah, no, for sure. What advice do you have for someone who's looking to get into the industry?
You just got to have great passion for it. And in our industry, you know, it's pretty dynamic. You can be on the sell side, you can be on the buy side, you can be an allocator like you guys are, Joe, and or financial advisors. And you have to just find the right spot, private equity, VC. Just you say, what aspect of the industry am I most interested in? And then you follow your passion. I think you reach out to people, you do informational interviews, try to get internship. And then you'll say, all right, this is the segment of the industry that fits my interests best. And it's a very dynamic industry. So that's what I advise young people to do.
Oh, that's great. That's great advice. And then, I mean, you have your own firm, you have your own funds. What sort of been the biggest challenge of running your own organization and your own investment funds?
I think recruiting and retaining good people, even though we haven't had a lot of turnover, but that's because this is a human capital business. And that's the key. And particularly being here in Cleveland, because you know, Joe, it's the difference of access to talent. And then I go back to needing to hire a controller here. That person has to be domiciled. So it's the people side is the most challenging aspect of running the business, is making sure you recruit and retain the people. And then it's never easy to grow the business and grow your AUM. It's a very competitive business. And that's a challenge, but it's a challenge for everyone in the industry. But I'd say on the people side, that's always the biggest challenge. And the markets are never easy. I mean, there's always volatility, and sometimes more than others. And so the markets are challenging as well. But that's what we signed up for. You're an investor, deal with volatile markets.
Yep, that's for sure. And then how do you define success, either the organization, you know, Fred Cummings, the analyst and the investor at Elizabeth Park, but also maybe even personally, like how do you define success in your life?
I think for Elizabeth Park, we started with 3 million, we got up to over 400 and now, you know, we are embarking, we're trying to get to $1 billion with this mission driven bank fund. And that's a huge opportunity set. Even if we don't reach that, we think we've been successful diversifying. So we got to get that up and running successfully over the next 9 months or so. And then we'll have three products. We've always wanted to be in private equity, and this gets us into private equity. But I define personal success as doing something that I've always wanted to do. So it's something that I love, having the freedom to do it, having the flexibility. We're very flexible with our workers. People can work from home. We have three analysts who work for their homes out of state. And we want to build a collegial culture. So I'm really having a lot of fun, and I can't see myself doing anything else. I love being my own boss, even though it's a lot of pressure, but it gives you a lot of options. But I, bad news, Joe, is no matter where I go and travel to, I'm working. And so,
all right, so
that's the reality. But that's the way it is when you're a business owner. You have to do that.
You kind of remind me of the mission-driven bank fund that you guys are working on raising capital for. What's sort of the idea behind that strategy?
The strategy with the mission-driven bank fund is really to help address the racial wealth gap by providing more capital to the minority depository institutions and the community development financial institutions that serve these economically challenge markets. And if we can provide the capital that we receive from Microsoft and Truist, the other anchor investors with $120 million, and Warner Brothers Discovery is also a lead investor, and the goal for us is to raise $350 to $1 billion to be invested into these institutions. And if we can help those institutions become more profitable, develop new products, improve their technology, they in turn can provide better service to the customers in their markets, and hopefully facilitate more home ownership, more business ownership, improve savings, and then you start really helping people in these communities accumulate more wealth. So this is something that's personal for me, having grown up in a community in Akron, the north side of Akron, Elizabeth Park, was a community which would have been representative of what the mission-driven bank of fund wanted to serve. So we're very excited to be partnering with Calvert Impact Capital in this effort.
That's great. And is the idea, this is a private sort of maybe like a drawdown fund. You guys are going to allocate money over some time, and then it's going to stay in those companies for a while as you guys sort of give them the capital they need to sort of
institutionalize. Yeah, this is a 10-year fund life. It'll stay. Yep. You really want to be their capital partners. And what's unique about it, Joe, is that we will provide technical assistance, and that is helping them with their operations, helping them with technology, helping them generate more loans, helping them attract deposits. Because some of them are small, and many of them are small, and they just don't have the internal resources, and maybe even helping them identify consultants. And so this is a full service approach. Not only do you provide the capital, but you also provide the technical assistance to help them improve their business operation. So it's a powerful combination. Our initial feedback has been quite positive, and we think a number of them, we're going to be raising capital primarily from banks, commercial banks who want to support their smaller brethren. And then frankly, a lot of the commercial banks are interested in receiving CRA credit. So since this is a public welfare fund, there will be a number of foundations who have an interest in the subject matter, and we expect demand for that segment to be strong. And then lastly, of course, similar to Microsoft, and there are a number of corporations who are focused on social responsibility and particularly from the standpoint of ESG, who will have interest in supporting this effort as well. So it should be a diversified LP base. And we're very excited. We'll be hopefully doing our formal marketing and here in the second quarter.
And so it sounds like a really great and interesting program. So sounds good. That sounds great. And then maybe to sort of wrap up the podcast, Do you have any books or movies that you would recommend for the audience, or maybe some of your favorites?
Oh, my favorite, this is my wife and I, when Harry Met Sally, Joe, that's my all-time favorite.
That's great.
That was a great,
well, that's a good one.
I know, that was a great movie. I think that there are others, but I have to say that was one of my all-time favorite movies, was when Harry Met Sally.
Oh, that's great. I think
I'm a big fan of Harry Connick Jr. as well.
That's awesome. That's good. Well, Fred, I think that's a great spot to end at. Really enjoyed this conversation with you. To the audience, thanks for listening. We hope you'll join us in June for our next episode. Thanks a lot, Fred. Appreciate it.
This podcast is being provided for informational purposes only. Any performance information discussed is based on past performance, which is not an indicator of future results. Performance discussed may or may not include the deduction of manager fees or Clearstead advisory fees, net performance, which would decrease the performance results discussed. If the performance information discussed does not explicitly disclose the deductions of manager and Clearstead advisory fees, the performance information should be reduced by 3-4% for all annualized time periods. The ideas and opinions expressed on this podcast by the host and the guests do not constitute legal, tax, or investment advice or a recommendation of any particular security or strategy, and do not represent the opinions of the underwriters of this programming. Any information prepared from third-party sources is believed to be reliable, though its accuracy is not guaranteed. Opinions expressed in this commentary reflect subjective judgments of the speakers based on conditions at the time of recording and are subject to change without notice. Listeners should seek the input of their own financial, tax, and legal professionals before acting on any recommendation of the information provided.